session, please be seated.
Counsel Weddick?
Please, sir.
Good morning, Senior Justice Berger, Justice Jacobson, Justice Ridgely. If I may introduce myself, I'm John Ettinger. I represent David Bauman, the appellant who's the defendant down below. The issue in this case was the appropriateness of placing before the jury collateral evidence of misconduct in the form of a violation of a protection from abuse or harassment conviction in order to contradict the direct testimony of the defendant, Mr. Bauman. First, was it appropriate for the court to permit the state to cross-examine Mr. Bauman about specific acts of misconduct? And also, was it appropriate to permit the state to present extrinsic evidence of specific acts of misconduct in order to rebut his answers to cross-examination?
First, can I interrupt for a second? I want to try and clarify where you stand on this. Do you agree that in light of what your client said about his relationship with the alleged victim here and with the other woman, that there was some basis for the state to cross-examine on that subject?
And yes, Your Honor, I would agree. But I think we need to make a distinction here, distinguish what he...
that comment is basically
that arose after the main project, and objection is relevant.
My initial objection was that this was irrelevant in a collateral matter that was inappropriate to be examined upon to begin with.
Right.
And then as we went down the path, he rose to the bait, the defendant, and then made a statement, a gratuitous statement on his part that I treat, I think the question of the prosecutors was, do you consider yourself a ladies' man? And I think his response was, I treat the ladies nicely. And on that basis, the prosecutor then announced that he wanted to introduce the prior convictions for a PFA.
Now, will you answer my question? Having made that comment about being nice to the ladies, or in substance that remark, why shouldn't the prosecution be entitled to impeach that statement with evidence of the prior PFA conviction?
What we're leading into is a collateral matter. There's nothing to say that a PFA in and of itself is rebutting, I treat the ladies nicely. We're heading into a collateral matter, which the basis upon which the nature of the PFA, other than having a conviction from protection from abuse order, does not necessarily, I would submit, is not proof that he does not treat the ladies nicely unless we actually have a separate trial on what entailed that protection from abuse order. Was it the fact that he did not treat the ladies nicely? What I'm driving at, Your Honor, is that by the mere fact that we've gone down this road of a collateral issue, we start tripping all sorts of wires of what would be inadmissible evidence. It was not the defendant.
You're saying it's not logically relevant to impeach.
That's
secondly, right. To the extent there is some relevance, it's marginal and outweighed by the prejudice.
Certainly, Your Honor, yes. And
did the trial judge give a limiting instruction?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
And was that in the closing instructions?
In the closing instructions, yes, he did.
And you requested that?
Yes, I believe that was requested in prayer conference, yes. What I was driving at initially was there's a distinction between Mr. Bauman's statement that he was engaged to be married to Carol Pyle and the fact that there are convictions for violations of a PFA and harassment conviction. The question is, if the defendant opened that door, then certainly the state could present rebuttal evidence in the form of Carol Pyle saying, no, we were not engaged. But to go beyond to talk about a PFA, well, first of all, to cross-examine them about the PFA, and first of all, to cross-examine Mr. Bauman about the harassment convictions, since neither one of those would bear on his credibility, since they're not crimes of dishonesty or of any nature, it would certainly be a collateral matter that would have no bearing or relevance on his truthfulness, and therefore that should have been excluded. Should the court, and the court in this case obviously found it relevant, beyond the cross-examination, the rebuttal evidence of Carol Pyle was certainly well beyond, because that was extrinsic evidence of a collateral matter. And by the very nature of the fact that putting Carol Pyle on the stand to discuss events that occurred in 2000, years before this incident occurred, opens itself, puts the defendant in an unfair advantage to litigate a second case while he's litigating the first case.
Let me ask you, I'll give you first a definition, since your argument is that this is a collateral matter, and get you to comment on it. Extrinsic evidence is material and not collateral if it contradicts, quote, any part of the witness's account of the background and circumstances of a material transaction which as a matter of human experience, he would not have been mistaken about if his story were true. And that's quoting McCormick on evidence.
And that would where I would draw the distinction between whether he was engaged or not to Carol Pyle, because that's all he said. I was going to get engaged to Carol Pyle. And that, he never testified on direct that I've never committed a PFA, I always treat my women fine. That was the kickoff point where upon which the prosecutor then wanted to cross-examine him about a PFA violation and a harassment conviction. Now, there was nothing in the direct testimony to say that, you know, I've never done anything wrong in my life, so it wasn't offered to rebut that. And certainly the prosecution has argued that somehow the defendant implied that he had a rosy relationship with Carol Pyle, and therefore it was incumbent upon the prosecution to introduce this evidence that they've had prior problems before. But there was no such evidence. And in that vein, the state overstepped. And furthermore, even if it was relevant, it would certainly, the prejudice of it outweighed any probative value. As been said, it was of marginal value as a piece of evidence.
Now, did the trial judge rule on under 403?
There was no objection or no request by defense counsel, by myself, for a 403 analysis. I made a lot of objections, but I did not request the court to make a 403 analysis.
So the basic thrust of what you're arguing is that it was basically overkill, not necessary in order to rebut the volunteered statement that I'm always nice to the ladies.
That would be our position, Your Honor.
But suppose the cross examination went this way. You know, Mr. Bowman, you said that you're always nice to the ladies. Isn't it true that one of the ladies that you supposedly were nice to, you abused? No. Well, wasn't a protection from abuse order issued against you? Yes. And didn't you violate that order? Yes. And weren't you convicted for it? Yes.
If at that point, and I would submit to the court, if he had originally testified on direct to that effect, then he's opened all the doors. That he treats the ladies nicely, he never has been...
Why would it be relevant if Mr. Bowman testified to it on direct but not on cross?
I objected to any questions about his relationships with other women as to what relevance does that have to the case at hand, which was involving Trish Kerr, which was a stalking and a harassment complaint. Whatever relevance did... have that he had good relationships or bad relationships. Unless the state is trying to use this under a 404B, in which he was operating in some, trying to show intent, motive, opportunity, or plan, there's absolutely no relevance except to besmirch Mr. Bauman's reputation from the jury. There was no relevance.
But didn't he, on direct, testify about his relationship with Carol Pyle and suggest at least that the timing of when he became engaged to her and when the complaining witness sought relief from the police overlapped or was very close in and leaving the obvious suggestion that, see, she was just jealous because I told her that I was going to go back with or go get married to this other woman.
What had happened was that Mr. Bowman got evaluated by the Dulles Psychiatric Hospital, and Dr. Foster, in her report to the court, had made a statement that Mr. Bowman said that he had told Carol Pyle about this, or I'm sorry, told Trish Kerr about this other woman, Carol Pyle, and that she did not understand about that. On direct testimony, Mr. Bowman had testified, I had asked my other girlfriend that I was going with for 4.5 years if she would marry me. She accepted. And then I mentioned to Trish at one time, I said to her, I wouldn't be calling her anymore. What I think happened
in the course of the trial, he testified that all he told Trish Kerr was that he was not going to see her, not going to see her anymore, because in his own mind he was engaged to Carol Pye. I think what happened was we were all reading from the state hospital report, which is that he had told her that he was going to get engaged.
You're using up some of your rebuttal time now. If you would like, you can save it or not.
I can address the court's questions if there are any more. Otherwise, I'll sit down and save it for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please, court. Let me just preface my remarks by borrowing a term phrase from equity, clean hands. Mr. Baumann does not come before this court today with clean hands. Mr. Baumann took the witness stand and he lied. He lied repeatedly. He made a mockery of the trial, or at least tried to. And it takes a certain amount of hubris for Mr. Baumann to come before this court today and say that he was not treated fairly. Mr. Baumann got exactly what he deserved. Now, I am not going to argue, waste the court's time arguing whether or not this issue has been preserved for appeal. My position is obvious from the opening brief that it has not been. The only objection raised was a relevance objection. And the evidence was obviously relevant. Mr. Edinger makes in his remarks just now, made some issue over the fact that the answer I always try to treat my ladies nicely, very nicely, was made on cross-examination as the defendant was somehow baited. But looking at page 815, which is when this came up, he was not baited whatsoever. On page 113 of the transcript, he finally, but Mr. Baum is extremely evasive witness, and getting something out of him is like pulling teeth. But he finally says that, yes, Trish, the complaining witness, is lying. And the prosecutor asks, why is she lying? And he gives this very evasive and non-responsive answer, which ends, and I have two daughters of my own, 26 and 24. And the prosecutor says, Your Honor, I'm going to ask that the last part be stretched to non-responsive to my question, and a little bit of a colloquy, and the judge says, I'll let it in. Okay, the prosecutor says, what do your daughters have to do with whether Trish is lying or not? And then the answer, out of left field, well, the point is, I always try to treat ladies very nicely. Now, he was not baited to say that. He just came out with it. Now, let me start my argument. This court is not bound by the prosecutor's theory of admissibility, obviously. So long as the evidence is admissible, so long as the jury properly heard it, it's properly in. I have a somewhat different theory of admissibility, and it does not deal with his statement on cross-examination. It deals with his statement on direct examination when he told two lies in one answer. Lie number one, that he just got engaged to Carol in Pennsylvania, who is, of course, Carol Pyle. And lie number two is that he met the complaining witness at church, and Mr. Baumann is very sure to make wants to make sure everybody knows that it's Christ Church on Buck Road, that he met her at church and broke off their relationship on Sunday morning, and then lo and behold, Sunday night, he's arrested by the police. Now, this testimony, obviously, both of which are lies, but this testimony obviously invites a jury to make two inferences. One, that Patricia Kerr, the complaining witness, as the familiar plot device, the woman scorned, immediately ran off to the police and made a false complaint, which resulted in his arrest. And inference number two is, I just got engaged to the woman of my dreams, or at least the woman I've been romancing for years, and why would I go around and harass somebody else in these circumstances? Now, these are not tangential or collateral matters. These two lies go right to the heart of the case, that the complaining witness has a reason to lie, to make a false complaint and to take the witness stand and lie about the stalking, her harassment actions, and lie number two, that because I just got married, I had no reason. It would be totally irrational for me to stalk this other woman when I just got engaged to this woman I've been romancing for 5 or 6 years. So, I mean, this evidence does not go to sort of generally impeach this guy. We're not talking here about general credibility. We're talking about something that goes right to the heart of the case here. That this guy, as far as Carol Pyle goes, well, he was harassing her in Delaware by following her into here and followed her right into the parking lot of Troop 6. Convicted of that, and the complaining witness had a protection from abuse order against him in Pennsylvania that he violated and was convicted of that. Now, we're not talking about general credibility. We're not talking about having ever been convicted of a felony or crime of dishonesty or false statement or anything like that, crimes that have absolutely nothing to do with the case at bar. No, these crimes, these actions of his that led to these convictions have everything to do with this case. They go right to the heart of the case. So it's my position here that as was the case in Weber v. State, which I suggest to the court is really kind of a key case. There, the victim's family had given money to some state's witnesses who were kind of low-lifes, so they could go out and buy clothing and present a nice appearance. And this court ruled that this simply isn't collateral evidence that this had been done, that the trial judge excluded it. The state wanted to bring it in. I think that's the way it worked. Now, the defense wanted to bring it in. The defense wanted to bring this in, I'm sorry. And the trial judge said it was collateral, not relevant. And this court said, no, it went right to the heart. In this case, it went right to the witness's bias. And bias is always a critical issue. So I think if there's one case I'm relying on primarily, it would be this court's decision in Weber. And this court reversed Weber's conviction because of that, because that evidence was excluded. So anyway, that's pretty much my theory. If the court has any questions, if the court has no questions, I will sit down.
Well, I do have
a
question. There's a difference between the Delaware Rules of Evidence and the Federal Rules of Evidence, 608B. Our rule essentially says that extrinsic evidence may not be used to prove specific instances of the conduct of the witness for the purpose of attacking or supporting the witness's credibility. The federal rule, which was amended in 2003, rephrases that for the purpose of attacking or supporting the witness's character for truthfulness. So what is the difference, if any, between credibility and character for truthfulness? How broad is credibility, and what does that preclude?
Just off the top of my head, I would say that credibility is, one could obviously say that the two are synonymous, but if there is a difference in wording, and if differences in wording in the law do make some kind of difference, there's some rationale behind using two different words, it seems to me that credibility would be more specific. Character, of course, is very general. Very general character for truthfulness. Now, credibility would be, in the case here, credibility on the witness stand, credibility of what the witness just said. We're not dealing here with character evidence. That's 404B, of course.
Are you suggesting a distinction between someone who lies all the time and someone who is just lying on this occasion?
Yes, could very well be. I don't like that phrase, character for truthfulness. That just seems to be to muddy the waters. I like our word better, credibility. But anyway, I don't know if that's helpful or not. But I'm not quite sure what character for truthfulness would entail. We're talking about witnesses on the stand and say, oh, no, this guy never tells the truth. He would know the truth if he fell over. That may very well be Mr. Bowman, I don't know, but we weren't talking about his general character for credibility. We're talking about what he talked about on the witness stand, you know, his lies, his perjury. And that certainly was dealt with the witness's credibility in this particular instance. Again, I don't know whether my...
So is it your position that 608 does or does not apply?
That's correct.
Which?
As it did not apply, as this court ruled in Weber, it did not apply. Because of the critical issue of the case.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors.
I could just use my last few minutes to respond briefly. The lies that Mr. Donovan speaks of I are nowhere reflected in the record. The testimony was that he told Trish Kerr that he was not going to call her anymore. There was no testimony in the direct that somehow that she became incensed, outraged, and would not talk to him. In fact, he thought, at least from the testimony, was that they were parting amicably. So the tale that Mr. Donovan has woven, which sounds very plausible and would have been a very good defense, but it was not presented at trial.
Wasn't the jury told, at least according to your client's version, that he goes to church that morning, tells the complaining witness that we're not going to see each other anymore, and then, you know, that same evening he gets arrested on her complaint. Now, does it take a genius to put together the inference that she was not happy? He's suggesting that she was offended by being told that the relationship was terminating.
Certainly, and that's agreed upon, and that would have probably, if we had not straight into the issue of Carol Pyle, would have been argued. But Carol Pyle was not the issue, and it certainly wasn't raised by Mr. Bowman that was the cause for her to raise the complaint. The state has argued it infinitely, but we've not ever said, or Mr. Bowman never said, that the reason Trish Kerr brought these charges against him was because she was jealous of Carol Pyle. That was nowhere in the transcript or in the record. The only mention was that he had accepted, or they agreed that Carol Pollard had accepted his offer to be married, and he had told Trish Kerr that he was going to end their relationship. And there was nothing in the record that I could see up to this point that Mr. Bowman said that she reacted in a negative way, only that he was arrested later that day. The issue of Carol Pyle was interjected by the state from the very beginning as to from the very first questions out of the prosecutor's mouth were tell us about Carol, and isn't it true that you told Dr. Talmo, but it's actually Dr. Foster, that Carol filed you violated a PFA order in her case, and that there was a harassment conviction in that case. And none of these were issues that never Mr. Bowen said, you know, I had a terrific relationship with Carol Pye, we've never had our downs. These all came subsequent to this area of cross-examination, which defense says that was a road that should have never been gone down, because what happened is similar things where statements are made, I treat the ladies nicely. And I just want to respond briefly to that. Mr. Donovan says he was not dated. Well, that question about treating ladies nicely came after the cross-examination. Isn't it true that you told Dr. Foster that you violated a PFA order? Isn't it true that you told Dr. Foster you had a harassment conviction? So trying to put Mr. Bowman in a bad light, he was baited into responding, no, I treat the in a different context, I treat the ladies very nicely. I say I only have 15 seconds left.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll take a very brief recess.
Please rise.